Hey everyone, it's Kenji. We are here at the Bell House in New York, and we're gonna cook some scrambled eggs with tomatoes. I'm here with my friend Ed Levine, who's on the other camera.
That is, of course, my old Sirius Heat running partner, J. Kenji Lopez Alt, cooking in his wok on stage at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York, with me as his sous chef. Yes, I know that's a stretch. Kenji is shooting a video for his YouTube channel, Kenji's Cooking Show, and we are, of course, recording another episode of Special Sauce, which will feature Kenji answering the sold-out audience's questions. I'm Ed Levine, founder of Sirius Eats, and this is Special Sauce, the podcast about food and life. We'll be right back with Kenji making a dish from his new book, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. We return to the stage at Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. Kenji put a GoPro camera on both his head and mine. He and I share a love of eggs in all forms, so unsurprisingly, Kenji decided to make a scrambled egg dish in his wok. He's already cut up some tomatoes and added eggs right in the wok, plus some fresh ginger, garlic, and salt. My job was to chop the scallions. I always get nervous cooking with Kenji, but I, for one, was very proud of my scallions.
One of your specialties is eggs in purgatory.
Yes, this right? is true. So eggs in purgatory, there's something like eggs in purgatory in every culture. It's a Southern Italian dish which you poach eggs in tomato sauce. And then sometimes you finish them in the broiler with breadcrumbs or in the oven. But it's this really simple, easy dish to make at home for dinner.
And so when I was a kid, my mom, she used to make a dish that she called to tama, to for tomato and tama for tamago. And apparently her mom, my grandmother, would make that dish for her when she was a kid. And so when I got married to my wife, Audrey, I once made to tama for her. And she's like, oh, this is like huevos pericos, which is like a Colombian dish of tomatoes and scallions scrambled with eggs. Yeah, and so this got me realizing, oh, God, like this is like a thing everywhere. Yeah, yeah, there's eggs in purgatory. There's Turkish menemen. There's huevos rancheros. There's like scrambled eggs with ketchup. You know, the idea of combining eggs and tomatoes is this kind of cross-cultural thing. It's a super common dish all over China that our mutual friend, Francis Lam, he says, like, it's like, you know, writing a recipe for scrambled eggs with tomatoes is like putting a recipe for like buttered toast.
I asked Kenji about the differences between cooking in a wok and cooking in a Western skillet.
So with a Western-style skillet, you're kind of building up these layers of polymers, which are, you know, oil. When you heat it, it polymerizes. It turns into this sort of plastic-like coating. And when you cook it over and over and over, you build these thick layers. That works in a Western-style skillet because you're generally trying to heat things to a relatively even temperature. You want an even temperature across the skillet. You're not going to be deglazing things often. So it's a relatively stable coating. Whereas on a wok, it's really difficult to build up a coating like that because usually you're heating the bottom of the wok a lot more than you're heating the sides. So you have this temperature differential and that causes stress. You're also constantly sort of deglazing it with cold liquids, with acids, with all these things that sort of strip away that seasoning. So when we talk about seasoning in a wok, we're not necessarily talking about the layers of polymers that you build up in a Western style skillet. What we're talking about is black oxide. So the black color that comes when you heat up carbon steel like this the very first time. It looked like this essentially after the first time I seasoned it. So like it, you know, half an hour after I got it out of the package or after I took it off the shelf and started doing it. And it's not really going to change much after that. You will build some layers of seasoning around the edges. The black oxide will get more and more even. So it will get better over time, but it's not like a cast iron skillet where you're like really building up thicker layers. The most important part of seasoning with a wok is more of a sort of per cook basis. So you can see I'm kind of trying to heat it up evenly all over the bottom surface. This is a round bottom wok. I'm doing it on an induction range. For most home cooks, I would recommend a flat bottom wok and a flat bottom induction range. This just happened to be the one that I had to take with me on my tour stuff. So with a wok, we're going to let it heat up like this.
We became a well-oiled machine, pun intended. I always enjoy hanging out and cooking with Kenji.
So we've preheated this for eggs. We've preheated. Now we're going to turn the heat pretty much all the way off. And so we're essentially making like an omelet here, right? And like I said, this wok, I've used it like a half dozen times and you can see it's like because of the proper way you preheat it, mm-hmm. it's essentially nonstick. If we had done this with slightly fewer eggs, that would build a slightly sort of thinner layer. There's this other recipe in my book for Guangzhou-style scrambled eggs, which essentially are like an omelet that you cook only from one side so that it gets these kind of golden waves of eggs, and then the top is sort of its own sauce. But this is going to be the basis for the eggs with tomatoes that we're cooking.
Someone from the audience shouted out a question. From what we could make out, they asked what oil to use when you're cooking in a wok. Surprisingly, Kenji said that there are many kinds of oil that will work well as long as the oil has a high smoke point and a neutral flavor.
The question was, what kind of oil am I using? This is rice bran oil. So you want basically any kind of high temperature friendly oil that's neutral in flavor for when you're stir frying.
That could be canola or grapeseed.
Grapeseed works great. Peanut works great. I use rice bran. Canola works too. Those can go in there.
Those are some beautiful scallions. Who cut those scallions?
Cut perfectly. So in the meantime here, I'm going to make a really quick cornstarch slurry that we're going to use to kind of thicken up the sauce as the tomatoes cook.
Can you define slurry for
us?
Yeah,
a slurry is like a thin mud. You know, I don't know. Is that the...
When you see someone cooking in a wok, you often see them quickly tossing or mixing the ingredients. Because of the high heat, you have to stay on your toes.
So do you have to worry about things overcooking in a wok? Sometimes, yes. And so if you're doing a real, like a stir fry that's quick, you do. You have to have all your mise en place. You have to have everything ready because like the garlic and ginger can burn when you put them in the oil, right? So you have to have everything ready. This is like relatively simple home style cookings. Okay. So it's all going to be much more relaxed. And a lot of the stuff that you're going to, that come in this book is relatively relaxed. What you can do now is you can take those eggs and fold them in and kind of break them and fold them and do it until it's nice.
Can I succeed in dragging down Kenji in our cooking demo? We'll find out when we return in a moment. But first, I'm going to put in a plug for the SpecialSaucePodcast.com, where you can find the entire library of Special Sauce. That's hundreds of episodes going back to 2015. We're back on stage at Bell House, where Kenji is showing us how to make an eggs and tomato dish. While working on folding the eggs, I ask Kenji about how he goes about developing his daughter's palate and eating habits.
When I finished writing the book and I turned in the manuscript, my wife and my daughter and I did a celebratory dinner where we had a tasting menu. It was my daughter's first, who's five now, but it was her first tasting menu ever. And we also got like caviar and did like fancy stuff, you know? So my daughter was like thrilled by this, that we went to a place where you don't order anything and they just bring you stuff. By the end of the meal, she was like standing on the table going like, caviar, So her birthday just passed and we asked her what she wanted to do for her birthday. And we were thinking like pizza, right? Or her last birthday, she wanted to go to the fish market and buy a bag of fish heads and roast them, you know, for like $15. And this time she was like, can we go to one of those restaurants where you just kind of like sit down and they bring you stuff and you don't have to order anything? And we're like, yeah, like a tasting menu? Yeah, I want a tasting menu. And I felt like simultaneously like parenting win and parenting fail.
I have to say that the eggs in the wok look pretty swell. The eggs were well cooked without being overdone and had a lovely texture. We wrapped up with some final touches on the eggs and tasted. Kenji waited for my verdict.
Doesn't need seasoning? How does it compare to your eggs in purgatory?
Better.
Faster?
Faster, just tastier. It's hot. I should have told you that, I guess. It is a little hot.
It's good.
It's good.
Now, with the cooking demo out of the way, I was hoping Kenji would make a job offer for me to become his full-time sous chef, but it was not to be. I managed to hide my disappointment as we sat back down to attend to some of the questions from our very hungry audience.
What's my favorite thing to cook in a wok that doesn't come from an East Asian? I don't know about like the thing I have the most fun doing, but the most common thing I cook in a wok that doesn't necessarily come from an East Asian tradition, it would be like non-Asian stocks. So like if I'm making like a roasted chicken stock or something, or like a couple of weeks ago, we had a duck and I had the carcass left over and I kind of chopped up the carcass and chopped up a bunch of vegetables and I stir fry it in the wok first and get it really nice and brown and then fill it with water and simmer it. And like a wok is like a really good shape for browning a lot of things, you know? So it makes it really, so normally, like if I was working in a restaurant, you know, you would put all those things on a tray, you would roast them in the oven, then you would take the tray, put it on top of the stovetop, heat it, deglaze it to get all the brown bits off and whatever, and then pour it into a stock pot, then fill it with water. And what I do is I just stir fry it until it's really nice and brown, then pour the water in, and you don't have to do any of that stuff.
Is that the difference essentially between an Asian stock and a Western stock?
No. I don't want to reduce either one, but yeah, most of that comes down more to sort of the aromatics and the cooking process as opposed to the cooking in a wok versus not.
What advice can you give someone trying to get young people, teens in paren, excited about food? Well, you've been talking about writing that maybe your next book was going to be about this very topic.
I do have plans to write a book about getting kids to cook, but I want my own kid to get a little older to see how things go. For my daughter's 5, so I can give you advice on how to get one particular 5-year-old to cook when your job is already to cook. As far as teens, you know, the general thing I've found from talking with people and from you know, working with kids and teaching is that the more you involve people in the process, the more they invested they are in the end result. And I feel like getting them involved and also getting them involved in a way that's not just busy work, you know, where they feel that they actually are empowered and have input over the end result. So that involves, first of all, like getting them involved in real parts of the cooking. And that's like a matter of like, you know, teaching them techniques. It's like, yeah, and practicing and doing it with them all the time and being okay, especially like with young kids. The important thing I think is being okay with the idea that initially, especially, it's going to make things a lot more difficult for you and a lot slower, and you're going to have a lot more messes to clean up and all these things. But the more they practice, the more useful they're going to get. You know, it's like my daughter uses a knife, like a real grown-up knife, and can cut whatever I give. It takes her longer, but she does it, right? And now that she's like past this phase where I'm not worried that she's going to cut herself or worried that she's going to make a huge mess or whatever, it doesn't slow down dinner at all. I think the one thing that's also really helped, especially with Alicia, was the thing I was talking about before where you ask them like, hey, come give this a taste. Tell me, you limit their responses. You don't just say, what can we add to here? You know, a green food coloring and Jello. It's like, yeah, but it's like, you say like, do you think this needs like a little more olive oil or maybe a little more pepper, right? And then she'll taste it and be like, they'll never say it doesn't need anything. It's always something. It's like, I think it needs a little more pepper. And then you put a little more pepper. And you know, I think the key is ask them their opinions on things so they're involved. And then anything that you ask them, honor their answer, no matter what the answer is, right? Because they don't want to feel like they're being patronized. Kids are real people, right? They don't want to feel like they're being patronized, and they don't want to feel that they're being ignored. So if you ask them a question, and you can design your questions, but if you ask them a question, you should always honor what they say. And then, you know, positive reinforcement while you're eating, talk about the cooking process. You know, like I cook with Alicia, and then sometimes my wife is not there while we're cooking. So Audrey will be eating dinner, and, you know, and I'll ask Alicia to explain like how Audrey will say, what are we having? And I'll ask Alicia to explain what we're having and how she cooked it.
So what would the first recipe, if you were cooking with a teenager or even a preteen, that people should make from the book?
So I wouldn't think about it in terms of recipes. I wouldn't give a kid like a recipe to do or a first-time cook a recipe to do. I would think about it in terms of techniques, right? And so, well, if we're talking like real little babies, real little kids, like technique-wise, like tasting and smelling and adjusting seasoning, like that's easy, right? You can give a kid things to smell. You can give kids like leaves to pick off herbs and ask them to smell them. So get them involved that way. But beyond that, it's like Alicia's first techniques were smashing things. Right. So it was like, I gave her a mortar
I'm
and pestle.
I'm really good at smashing.
But no, it's a useful thing, right? So I gave her a mortar and pestle, and I'm like, here's a few knobs of ginger, here's some garlic, smash it, you know, and she would smash it, and then that would go into the meal. And then during the meal, we can say, oh, this has like just the right amount of garlic, whatever. And, you know, it's something that like, it takes her a long time, but she's really into it. And it's something that is actually useful and goes into the meal, you know, or you can say like, here's some like mushrooms, smash them, you know, it's like, and then we'll make a sauce out of them. You don't have to chop them, you just smash them. Or like, here's some breadcrumbs. We're going to like toast them, put on the pastry, like smash them. So it's like, so you teach them techniques wise. So with Alicia, it started with smashing and plucking. And then we moved on to like measuring and stirring and whisking. You know, once you start stirring in a bowl and you can see like, okay, she can stir this pancake batter without getting it all over everything, then you can move on to stirring stuff in a pot because you know that she's not going to get the hot oil and the food all over everything. So you don't think about it in terms of recipes. You think about it more in terms of techniques. And so when you look at a recipe, and this will all be in my next book, which will be out in 17 years. So instead of thinking to yourself like, oh, these are techniques I know, or these are flavors or whatever, you think this is a part where Alicia knows those types of techniques. I can give her this to do and she'll do it. And she'll feel like she's contributed. I mean, she will have contributed. People, and especially kids, want to feel useful, right? And they want to be acknowledged for their usefulness.
And what technique would then you have all of these lovely people out here make from the book?
So something like the first stir fry recipe in the book is like a Chinese American style Kung Pao chicken. It has a lot of ingredients, whatever, but it's all a relatively simple process. It's not super involved. You know, it doesn't require crazy heat. You can relax a little bit, but it will teach you the basics of like cooking in batches and then saucing properly and all that. And as far as like even simpler than that, I would go towards dishes that are more like in the braised category. So like my mom's mapo tofu, which I wrote in the book that it was made with soy sauce, sake, and mirin. And last night my mom told me, I never put mirin in there.
Of course.
Mapo tofu comes from Sichuan. But it was introduced to Japan like in the 70s and of course adopted the flavors. So the Japanese style of mapo tofu is something that was my favorite thing. We called it mapo gorp. It was my favorite thing growing up. And it's like one of my daughter's favorite things now. And it's very simple, takes 10 minutes. I can give my daughter ginger and garlic to smash and she knows how to do it. All you do is like chop some scallions, saute some ground meat, and then add a few seasonings. And it's very, very simple and hearty and delicious and takes 10 minutes and is, I would say, probably the easiest. As far as like ease to satisfaction ratio goes, probably the best one in the book.
Somebody wants to know about how heat is distributed on a wok, which is different than a Western pan. Can you talk a little bit about how heat is distributed on a wok?
Yeah. So on a Western skillet, your goal is to get even heating all across the bottom surface. So that's true whether you're sweating vegetables as the beginning of like a soup or a stew or like a fricassee, something. You're sweating vegetables out. You want everything to be evenly heated so that nothing is heating too fast and everything is kind of slowly cooking. Or if you're searing a steak, you don't want a hot spot and a cold, like one steak to be searing hot and another one to be searing cold. With a wok, you generally want the bottom area to be extremely hot and then for the heat to slowly taper as it goes up the sides. The idea is that if you want to cook everything quickly, you know, the same way that you would want to sear a bunch of steaks quickly at the same time, you're stir frying, right? So which should really be toss frying. So you're tossing things. So everything in the wok is tumbling over itself and moving through the same temperature zones. So everything is cooking relatively quickly and at the same rate. And that tossing motion also, you know, it also encourages the evaporation of steam so that you're not stewing things in their own juices and you get this really dry heat. But with a wok, the advantage of having these multiple temperature zones is that you can cook things in different ways. So for example, like I think the most explicit example in the book would be something like the pad thai recipe, where you start by cooking the noodles and you cook some aromatics and you cook the noodles in sauce. And when the noodles are done, you kind of push them on the side. And then the bottom of the wok is still really hot. And so you sear some shrimp down there and then you push them aside. Then you scramble some eggs down there and then you toss it all together. And so you would do the same thing if you're making like certain styles of fried rice. You toss your aromatics and your vegetables and your rice, and then you kind of push them to the side, get that bottom really hot. So the bottom gets really hot, the sides don't. And then you can add your egg to the bottom and scramble your egg in there. Or in most stir fries also, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be stir frying everything, putting it back in and letting it sit in the center of the wok. And so when you do that, you know, that draws some of the heat out of the center, but there's nothing touching the bare metal on the outside. So that can start to heat up. And then when you add your sauce is going to really rapidly sort of sear, which changes its flavor, rapidly reduces it, and gives it more of an intense flavor. And that's something that you can do in a wok that you can't do in a Western skillet.
It's almost like a wok is like a wood-burning pizza oven, right? Because there's different temperature zones.
So when I was a Knight of the Round Grill, you always had to cook the proteins on one part of the grill and the seafood on another because it was all different temperature ranges there.
So I grew up with minimal Asian food influences. I was mostly Italian food, American food, burger, steak, etc. With that in mind, is a wok something I should own? Is there utility to owning a wok over other pots and pans? I think you've answered that. And should I make my meatballs in a wok?
There's a couple ways to answer that question. If all you're interested in doing is cooking the same things you've cooked growing up, and talking specifically to this person, and you're very happy with your repertoire and you're happy with your lifestyle and the way you're doing things, there's no reason to change it. There's no reason to change what you're doing if you're happy with what you're doing. That said, I do think that If you're not familiar with wok cooking, or especially if you're just starting out cooking, or if you find yourself in a new part of your life where you don't have as much time to cook as you did before, I think a wok is the most inexpensive way. A wok plus my book, or a number of really good free websites and YouTube channels and all these things that I love. A wok plus some good technique is, I think, the easiest way to sort of explode your arsenal of techniques and recipes and things that you can do on an easy basis. So as far as like expanding your repertoire, if you're not familiar with the wealth of sort of wok techniques, it will give you like a huge arsenal of new things to work with, and new ingredients to think about and new ways to think about cooking. Because, you know, it's like Western cooking, it's like you think about like the Maillard reaction and reducing and braising and all these sort of slow processes where you concentrate flavors. And there is some of that in East Asian cuisine, of course. There is some of those dishes. But a lot of the sort of staple dishes and the things you'll do every day, you don't think about the Maillard. You like when you're stir frying meat, you're not getting any kind of real Maillard reaction there. You're not sitting there and waiting for your beef to sear, right? Instead of getting those sort of umami intense flavors through slow reductions of sauces and Maillard reactions, you're getting them more through, you're focusing more, like most proteins and vegetables cook really fast, whether you're steaming, whether you're simmering, whether you're braising, whether you're stir frying, they cook fast. And to build flavors, you're relying a lot more on sort of the balance of intense aromatics. So spices and herbs and roots and thing, you know, garlic and ginger and all these things that supply intense aromatics and how to maximize those aromas and keep them fresh. And then you're also relying a lot on heavily fermented aged sauces. So like soy sauces and bean paste and chili paste and all these fermented things that have these umami intense flavors built in that you're using to season your food with at the end. So it's a very different way of thinking about food if you're used to sort of Western cooking standards, thinking of these like East Asian cooking standards. It's a very different way of thinking about it. So I think if you're in the market for expanding your horizons cooking wise, it's an inexpensive way to do it.
This is a question is from a physics teacher. So he might be
crap.
No, he just might be biased in what he wants your answer to be. Which science class has influenced your cooking the most?
I mean, physics, right? Yeah, for sure. Physics.
See?
I've had two teachers in my life who questioned why I was doing what I was doing. In high school, I had my teacher, Mr. Harless. Mr. Harless was my physics teacher. And when I was applying to college, right, I was thinking about going to either music school or to regular school. And Mr. Harless was like, Kenji, like, you got into MIT. Why wouldn't you just go there? Like, people die to go there. You should just go there. And I was like, I guess I should. He was one of these people who's like, your happiness should be the goal, not just solving the problem. Like, your overall happiness should be the goal. And then the other teacher was my senior year architecture professor at MIT, who in one of our studio classes, all the students were supposed to bring like a special personal project that they wanted to work on, right, and present it to the class. And mine was on creme brulee and how egg proteins set. And then I brought this to the class, and then like I realized everyone else had done like architecture stuff. And my professor, Dr. Jocelyn, he was like, Kenji, why do you want to do architecture? I was like, I don't know. I don't really want to. He's like, you should go into cooking.
And you did that.
And I did.
How happy was your mom when you made that decision?
Very, ask her. Very unhappy.
That's it for part two of my conversation with Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of The Wok, Recipes and Techniques, recorded live at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. This episode was produced by Pedro Rafael Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez of PRX Productions. Special thanks to the good folks at the Bell House and Josie Smith of Greenlight Bookstore. Keep an eye out for the video of our cooking demo on Kenji's YouTube channel. Join us next time on Special Sauce, when the extraordinary Detroit food activist Davita Davidson joins me. And if you want more Special Sauce in your life, just subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to the specialsaucepodcast.com where you'll find every episode we've ever done. I'm Ed Levine. Thanks for listening to Special Sauce. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.